Hi, it's Dave. Welcome to the show. Today, we're talking about Bitcoin. I'm joined by Dan Held. He is the growth lead at Kraken. And one of his specialties is he's able to explain Bitcoin simply. He's got a great YouTube channel on Bitcoin, but also he's got a very popular Twitter following. And I will link to both the YouTube channel and the Twitter following in the video description. So I want to welcome Dan Held.
Thanks for having me, Dave. I'm looking forward to talking about Bitcoin today.
Yeah, it's exciting. So Bitcoin is in the news a lot this past few weeks. Are you surprised at all by all of the attention it's gaining? Like even with, like, for example, Elon Musk, you know, putting in $1.5 billion in Bitcoin. Like what's been your reaction?
So I've been in Bitcoin for 8 years. The first time I bought Bitcoin was when it was worth $10. So it's been a long time for me. Back when I got into it, we were considered kind of crazy. I mean, Bitcoin back in that day was considered a very fringe new technology, a fringe new type of money. And now we're seeing companies like Tesla buy it and purchase it for their treasury. This is a huge moment for the space. I think it's a great validation metric of how far Bitcoin has come to be legitimate in the eyes of corporations and in the eyes of like big hedge funds. A lot of the top hedge funds across the world have been buying it as well. So yeah, I couldn't be more thrilled about where we are now. And this is a really exciting moment for Bitcoin.
Yeah, it seems monumental in a sense of not just Tesla buying, but Elon Musk is now tweeting about crypto. It almost seems like half his tweets for the past week have been on crypto. He tweets about Bitcoin probably almost as much as Dogecoin, but probably not as much.
Yeah, for those who don't know, Dogecoin is kind of a funny meme coin. It started from the Doge meme, and someone made a coin out of it. And I think Elon finds it very hilarious, and so he tweets about that often.
Yeah, for some reason, it seems like he actually is partially serious about it too, right? I don't know if you've caught in that.
It's hard to tell with Elon. He's kind of quirky.
Yeah, definitely. So your journey with Bitcoin has been quite long. You've seen kind of the, you know, ups and downs of Bitcoin, the different waves of enthusiasm followed by kind of, you know, times of adjustment and getting back that enthusiasm. But over the years, have you been kind of, what's your impressions been about kind of the fan base, the believers? It seems like that's one of the most defining elements of Bitcoin is the user base is so convicted. They're hardcore believers, you know, in Bitcoin. Like, where does that come from? What's your take?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that really targets the core heart of what is value and why is something valuable. Something is valuable because we all subjectively believe it has value. The dollar is just like Bitcoin in terms of it's a belief system in that this unit, this dollar, this Bitcoin is worth something. And when it comes to network effect, Bitcoin is starting off from a very small, you know, size zero group. You know, when Bitcoin wasn't around, it was Satoshi, so one person. And then more and more folks started to believe. And Bitcoin rewards early believers in it who understand the technology, who understand the promise it brings and the value it brings to the world, because there's only 21 million Bitcoin in existence, whoever buys it earlier. As demand increases, those per unit, so each Bitcoin goes up in value because there's a limited supply, increase in demand. Bitcoin, again, is very similar to traditional fiat currency in regards to it's a belief-based system. I was actually at a conference in Germany where a German central banker was there, and he leaned over and he whispered to the Bitcoiners, he goes, "My religion is bigger than yours." He's right. The euro, it has more believers and more folks who store their value in it right now. And that's the opportunity here with Bitcoin. And we'll dive into some of the Bitcoin's mechanics, why it's valuable, what value props does it solve for. We'll dive into that a little bit deeper. But you know, at its core, Bitcoin's a really interesting opportunity because it's kind of like an early stage investment in a new tech company. But this is an early stage investment in a new form of money. And this isn't just going to be a $1 trillion company, right? Like this isn't going to be the next Apple. A new money is magnitudes bigger than an Apple, magnitudes bigger than countries, like entire GDPs of countries. So that's where the opportunity is. I think that's what's so exciting about Bitcoin is I believed in it when it was only worth a few $1 billion market cap. Now we're getting like $700 trillion market cap, or $700 billion market cap, but we haven't even become like a gold 2.0. Gold, for instance, is worth $10 trillion. So I think it's very early in Bitcoin cycle.
Mm-hmm. What would you say? I mean, you talk about, you know, gold or Bitcoin as this digital gold store of value. Would you consider that the main value proposition for Bitcoin?
Yeah, so Satoshi built blockchain technology to build Bitcoin. Blockchain technology is this really kind of clunky technology that only enables certain types of values, or like it's like a specialized tool, right? It's kind of like a tank. You build a tank not to do ride sharing. You do it to serve a very specific function around defense. A blockchain is a similar thing, and that's why Satoshi built the Bitcoin blockchain the way he did, was to build a gold 2.0. And so the value props that he built it for were to solve the problem of trust. So Satoshi's first writing after the white paper, he says, and this isn't verbatim, but it's very directionally on point. He goes, the core root of the problem starts with trust. We have to trust that our central banks won't print more money. We have to trust that the banks hold all of our money there and haven't lent out too much and that they won't collapse. We have to trust the merchant processors. He's solving the problem of trust, and that's what Bitcoin solves, is it uses blockchain technology to solve the problem of trust. And that's important because trust underpins all financial arrangements. Money, this core underlying settlement mechanism for every economic activity that we do, the idea that there is a human level of trust that we have to insert into that is a weak point for all money. Hence why the 2008 financial crisis happened. We had all these layers of trust-based systems, and Bitcoin rebuilds that with a trustless system. So Bitcoin's core value prop is being able to store value in Bitcoin without having to trust anyone else.
Mm-hmm. What would you say to folks who say, well, Satoshi's original white paper, it was more peer-to-peer cash. You know, it was more this exchange. The main focus wasn't necessarily store value. But over time, because Bitcoin wasn't able to fulfill this medium of exchange completely, that original value or vision, it shifted its focus into becoming a store value. What's your thoughts?
That's a great question. And in Silicon Valley, I live out in San Francisco, we call this a pivot, right? Mm-hmm. Bitcoin did not pivot. So Bitcoin's narrative of both being used for a better way to have peer-to-peer payments and Bitcoin being used as gold 2.0, both of those narratives were persistent since day one. Bitcoin's white paper was only one piece of documentation included with a bunch of other documentation that Satoshi created. In fact, Satoshi actually says the functional details are not in the white paper. So, for example, like the 21 million hard cap for Bitcoin's supply, that is not on the white paper, amongst other things. The white paper was sort of a marketing message for his target audience. So when you launch a new money like this, who do you tell about it first? Like, this is a weird new thing that very few people would get. He published it on something called the Cryptographer Mailing List, which was a list where a bunch of geeks, for all intents and purposes, a bunch of cryptographer geeks geeked out on the idea of cryptocurrency for a long time. In fact, Satoshi built Bitcoin based on some of their ideas. So he publishes this white paper to get them excited about it. And that's where he uses peer-to-peer cash. Now, in that context, the cypherpunks think of cash in two ways, private and final, which means like once you have the cash, it's like a bearer asset. When you hold the cash, it's yours. And that's why he uses that language. It's not cash in your pocket. So, you know, one, if we're going to look at like the intent in the white paper, he very much means for it to be a marketing message. If we look at all of his other writings, he refers to Bitcoin as a precious metal or gold at least five times. If we look at the architecture of how Bitcoin is built, it is built as a gold 2.0. For example, if Satoshi wanted to be used for payments, we wouldn't see a 21 million hard cap for a supply. We would see the supply increase as demand increased. That way there would be a stable purchasing power. Just like the dollar. The dollar continually declines in value over time, but it is stable on a year-over-year basis enough that where people can mentally calibrate their spending around it. So Bitcoin architecture-wise, intent-wise, everything lines up for a gold 2.0 narrative. The payments narrative also was persistent since day one, but TLDR, Bitcoin did not pivot. Gold 2.0 has been around there since the beginning.
Why do you think Bitcoin hasn't evolved to what perhaps some people originally thought in the very, very early days, that Bitcoin could become this ultimate payment system to disrupt, you know, entire payment networks?
Yeah, it's natural that folks go, well, I've got these dollars and these euros. Why can't I go spend this? That's money for them, right? So it's totally natural to go and evaluate Bitcoin's performance, to look at existing fiat money and think about how you use that fiat money on a day-to-day basis. So when a new money comes into an existence, it can't skip to those stages that we call medium of exchange and unit of account stages. Unit of account stage would be there are dollars on my groceries. When I go to the grocery store, there's dollar tags on the different items to tell me what unit of account I can price things in. Medium of exchange is what I use at the cash register. But there's a stage before that called store of value that has to occur. A money needs to be believed in and have value stored in it by a large number of people before it can become a medium of exchange and unit of account. If no one has the coin, then you can't spend it. It's kind of the simple answer. And that's why we have to go through the store of value stage first. So Bitcoin in the medium of exchange unit of account era, as you might imagine your local fiat currency, your local government currency, that takes a long time, at least another decade or two. As younger people more buy into Bitcoin, as more and more folks across the world own Bitcoin, there's a network effect that develops. After a certain amount of time, let's say 60% of the population owns Bitcoin, and folks decide to prefer that in their payments, then Bitcoin slowly transitions, not transitions, more of an additive layer to that medium of exchange and unit of account era. But this is a multi-decade thing. I mean, money isn't just code or paper. It's a belief system, as we covered earlier. And when it's a belief system, it takes a long time for that to permeate. I mean, fiat money is reinforced by like the school system. The school system in the US is basically mandatory and taught by state curriculum. So like the idea of any other money other than the state or government money, mm-hmm. it's going to take a little while for people to believe in that.
Okay. Let's dive a bit more into this. So let's say you have a online game or a metaverse, and people are using, you know, a digital virtual currency within that metaverse. Let's take an example of, you know, Fortnite, or let's say Roblox, you know, and you have Robux, right? Is that money?
Yeah, I would say that's money. There's a lot of different types of money. Even cigarettes can be money when they're used in prison. So money, you can think about like a lot, there's a lot of different things that can be money. How good of a money is it, is a different question.
Mm-hmm. How is it that these metaverses and games can have millions and millions of people buying, let's say, you know, exchanging for these online virtual currencies, using them in hundreds of billions of transactions every day within these ecosystems? And, you know, there's so much peer-to-peer transactions already going on digitally, but Bitcoin is not being used as much for just daily purchases. Like you're saying it takes time for money to be adopted, but look at these metaverses and games, like instantly you have hundreds of millions of people spending, you know, tons of money exchanging hands.
Yeah, that's a fun one to dig in on. So when it comes to these different completely controlled universes, the completely controlled nature of those digital or virtual currencies is antithetical to what Bitcoin represents. So these digital currencies are very much like the dollar. It's completely controlled by the government in terms of the amount that exists and where you can store it other than the paper version. And so with that, they can control all these different levers of how you should use it. For example, like the US government forces you to pay your taxes in dollars. And with these virtual games, they can force you to pay for certain items using these type of these different digital assets. So in that regard, they completely control the economy, the supply, and the usage of it. So that's how they can stimulate the usage of it in that setting. Bitcoin's value prop is that it's not controlled. So there's no central control mechanism for Bitcoin, whether that be the monetary policy or the network itself. It's a decentralized network. Decentralized networks run a little bit slower and a whole lot less throughput than something like a video game server. So I play Call of Duty and there's in-game buying. Well, there's a lot of people playing Call of Duty and there's no way that a blockchain could handle something like that. The reason why we need a blockchain for Bitcoin in that trustless environment with that decentralized nature is that we can store value in it and there's no central point of control. With these virtual currencies, those balances are only available because the company lets you have that balance. They can freeze it, like if anyone's had their PayPal account or eBay account frozen, similar sort of circumstance. So Bitcoin is a different type of money. Those virtual currencies, those digital currencies inside games, those are very much controlled, very, very similar to fiat currency or government currency, whereas Bitcoin is a decentralized currency that has no central control mechanism. So the adoption curve there, we see people buying into it to store value that is hard to seize, and they can send that value anywhere they'd like. So a very distinctively different use case.
Okay. What would you say to someone who hears that and says, you know, it's not perhaps just the decentralized nature, it's more of the inherent energy usage, the inherent costs of proof of work to secure the Bitcoin network that makes it inherently expensive to do tiny transactions on, let's say, the Bitcoin blockchain? That's the main reason why there hasn't been, let's say, a proliferation of small payments using Bitcoin. What's your kind of take on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Bitcoin's blockchain, as I kind of mentioned before, has a lot of different design parameters that are geared towards enabling it to be that trustless money through that decentralized mechanism. That requires a lot of trade-offs. Like anything in life, we can't have everything. Like I mentioned before with a tank, it's a very specialized instrument. So there's a couple of different things that are parameter limits on how Bitcoin functions. We'll cover proof of work first because that's what you brought up initially. Proof of work is the mechanism in which Bitcoin produces new Bitcoins and also protects the network or validates transactions. So what happens is that in every 10 minutes, there's a Bitcoin block that is produced. A block is produced through miners. Miners expend energy using what we call proof of work. It proves that they did the work. And through that energy output, they essentially validate that they've done the work, which gives them a lottery mechanic vote that gives them some percentage allocation probability of getting that Bitcoin block. This is getting a little bit into the weeds, so I'll try my best to make this simple. Those Bitcoin miners expend the energy and they receive Bitcoin in reward for their efforts in that block reward, every Bitcoin block every 10 minutes. Bitcoin's issuance schedule of new Bitcoins taps out at 21 million over time. And Bitcoin needs to produce those in a predictable fashion. That's all transparent and auditable. So those newly minted coins are included in the Bitcoin block and transactions. So if I transacted within that 10 minutes on the Bitcoin ledger, that my transaction is in that block. And then after a Bitcoin miner mines it, those new coins are issued and those transactions are, you can imagine them being kind of burnt in, stamped in time. And then as those get stamped more and more with more Bitcoin blocks, your transaction becomes more and more permanently recorded in the ledger. So kind of like a layers of amber, if you will. It's like layers of amber over time. So Bitcoin's proof of work function isn't a wasteful thing. It does something very useful, which is protect the network. It protects the ordering of transactions. And this is why it's an inherently expensive thing. Bitcoin's record of transactions and keeping those in a linear function to make sure that people can't go back and change the record of what happened. It requires that proof of work function because that is the game theory behind it. By expending the proof of work, the miners now have financial skin in the game to behave properly and order the transactions properly. This gets really into the nuts and bolts of the game theory behind Bitcoin, and I'm not sure this might get a little too deep, but essentially that's how Bitcoin works, which is kind of a mind-blowing idea that Bitcoin's network eats energy and uses that to secure the ledger. And it offers the miners a block reward as a reward to behave properly. And so you can kind of think about it as like if the block reward was too low, the miners would have no incentive to behave properly and they might try to reorganize transactions. And that's called like a 51% attack or a reorg attack. But due to how expensive those blocks are in terms of energy output, aka cost, and how much value is in the block reward, it's a huge reward to behave properly to the tune of tens of billions. So Bitcoin's network is essentially protected by this game theory and energy consumption. So the energy consumption is not a bad thing. And if we look at the existing financial system, think about how much energy the US government uses to have the dollar. Printing presses, local bank branches, all the people who work at the different local bank branches, the Fed, the Treasury, the US military, the courts, all of those play into the energy consumption of the existing financial system. So Bitcoin uses magnitudes less than that. The energy consumption itself is very critical to the integrity of the network. And then let's see, what was the second part of the question you had? You covered Bitcoin before.
I mean, the essence of the question is, does the proof of work, the inherent costs required, right, for proof of work, does that kind of prohibit or inhibit Bitcoin's ability
Oh,
to
yeah.
become a payment network of small, tiny payments, right, with billions and billions of transactions
Yeah.
every hour or whatever?
Right. So, yeah, we've got these very restrictive design parameters, and Bitcoin has a limited block size, which can only include so many transactions. That is intentional. There's a lot of different technical reasons why, but let's just leave it at that. The way that Bitcoin scales to being that payment method for everything, you know, millions of transactions a second all across the world for everything you could imagine, it does that through scaling technology called layers. So on layer two, there's a protocol called Lightning. What Lightning does is imagine like you and I open up something called a Lightning channel, and we have that channel open for 2 weeks, and you and I transact back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. At the end of the 2 weeks, the net balance between us settles on the Bitcoin layer one blockchain. That's an example of how Bitcoin scales to be utilized for everyday day-to-day payments and to be equivalent to like Visa transaction throughput. So Bitcoin layer one is kept constrained intentionally to preserve decentralization and other parameters. And the scaling tech is pushed to layers above that, called like layer two.
Yeah. I mean, when I look at the layer two, you know, applications, for example, like Lightning, I'm just not seeing the usage uptake that it would appear would be needed to really become a dominant payment network. Like, for example, I'm not seeing it 10x in usage every year. You know, it's just not what maybe what people were hoping for it for a couple years ago in terms of its usage growth. But when I look at stuff hypothetically, let's say on a different blockchain like Ethereum, like I'm seeing a lot of usage growth on that blockchain with decentralized finance applications, people lending, borrowing, exchanging, et cetera. Is it possible, like, you know, that Bitcoin's like just inherently isn't as capable of being that, you know, kind of all payment network, you know, with tiny transactions? Is it possible that Bitcoin is relegated to more of a large payment network? What's your thoughts?
Yeah, so that's a great question of Bitcoin's blockchain versus other blockchains. Would another blockchain be useful for this? So Bitcoin's core value prop again is around store of value, gold 2.0. So it doesn't really need to step into that medium of exchange unit of account use case for another decade or two. Again, it's a network effect thing where large amounts of people have to believe in it, store value in it before it transitions into that next stage. When it comes to transactional throughput, Ethereum's blockchain is similarly constrained to Bitcoin. So yes, there is a lot of activity going on with Ethereum. But Ethereum transaction fees just for a base Ethereum transaction is higher than Bitcoin. So let's put it this way. Bitcoin transaction fees and Ethereum transaction fees for a regular transaction are around $5 to $7, which means to send any amount of value on those chains costs at least that much. Both chains have constraints over their block size and other parameters because that's how the blockchains operate in a way that's decentralized. Blockchains are they're not very good to be a Visa or a PayPal. They're just not very good at that inherently due to the design parameters of having. For example, you might have heard of a Bitcoin node, right? A Bitcoin node has a ledger of all Bitcoin transactions. Well, every Bitcoin node that's run increases Bitcoin's decentralization a little bit. And with that, you've decreased the efficiency because you have a copy of the ledger. And the most cheapest way to store that data would just be to have a copy of the ledger on my computer and your computer. But now we've got the copy on like 100,000 computers. So it's 100,000 times less efficient. And so when we look at blockchain technology, it's not made to be a permanent record to store all these little to coffee transactions. That's why like both Lightning, both Bitcoin through Lightning and Ethereum through other scaling tech are both pushing the scaling to the next level above. I know, for example, like Ethereum's thinking about sharding in Ethereum 2.0, which allowed them to increase their transactional throughput. But yes, Ethereum has a lot of activity, but also they're experiencing very much the same sort of constraints that Bitcoin has. If you're doing a smart contract on Ethereum, the fees could be in the hundreds of dollars, for example, if you wanted to swap between different assets. So both chains inherently have congestion issues based on the design parameters of how blockchains are built.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let's dive into this concept of comparing blockchains. Let's say we'll focus mostly on Bitcoin here, but with its inherent pros and cons. For example, by having the pro of decentralized network, you do have a con where it can be pricey to protect that network through proof of work. I mean, that's the essence of how Bitcoin seems like it manages that game is the only way it's able to be as decentralized as it is it takes immense amount of power of proof of work to secure the network, right? Which is very costly. Compare that to, let's say, a central bank current digital currency, or let's say you know, China or the US or the EU creates their own digital network, that digital currency. And rather than making it based off of proof of work, because there's no need for them to make it decentralized, they can make it obviously centralized. Theoretically, I mean, there are obviously cons of having a centralized database in many, many ways, right? But wouldn't one of the pros be that it would be so much less expensive in terms of, and so much more efficient than a decentralized network, because it's just a centralized database. You just, you know, quickly just input stuff. What's your take?
Well, the centralized database requires trust to make it all work. If we trust the centralized database has those records, and to have that trust, let's look at the existing financial system. We've got courts. We have the U.S. military, which is the largest consumer of energy in the world. Think about the energy consumption of a nuclear-powered battleship. Now multiply that by like 50. Then multiply that by aircraft carriers, submarines, bombers, a million soldiers, a million soldiers' homes, a million soldiers' food, etc. So those all reinforce trust in that central ledger, because we only trust that centralized ledger if there's enforcement behind it or there's some sort of belief in it. Then you have the Fed. The Fed employs, I believe, over 10,000 people, and the Fed has all these buildings, like in New York and San Francisco, giant buildings. How much energy did that cost to build those buildings and keep the electricity on and feed all the people in it? Then we have all the bank branches. And we have the Visa servers and the Visa company. I mean, Visa has like 30,000 employees. And then, so if you start to add all these on, what happens is that you look at the existing financial system and you're like, whoa, this is a ton of energy. Bitcoin is actually more efficient using proof of work than all of this aggregate energy usage across all these companies. What Bitcoin is different, this is the reason why this keeps coming up. Bitcoin's energy consumption is explicit and distilled down to a single metric that anyone can see. So it makes it much easier to go point at it and go, that's a lot of energy. Versus like, who wants to do the mental math of thinking through all the energy of all the warships, courts, Fed, Visa? The number becomes so unfathomably large and hard to calculate that we do know it's gigantic magnitudes higher than Bitcoin. It's just harder to calculate in that. And, you know, a lot of folks just don't want to do the mental math to compare the two.
I mean, I get like the current infrastructure of, you know, the financial system is immense and takes obviously a lot of energy to run that. But I'm trying not to make, let's say, analogy with the current infrastructure, current system. I'm talking more about, let's say, in the future, hypothetically, because obviously there's going to be a lot of disruption in the financial system, you know, like what we know today with banks and system. Like, I don't even want to compare it because it's getting antiquated before our own eyes. But if you look at purely just a federal digital currency, right, using a centralized database, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but that in and of itself, just that, it seems like that would be almost infinitively scalable. It could handle every single payment, right? Like super quick, super fast. And the government can basically instill trust through laws, right? And through their whole force. Like
through the police, through the military,
I mean, yeah,
through the court.
I'm not saying, well, actually in terms of, but what I'm saying is the whole system gets, its validity through not just the system, but the centralized, I guess, system gets the benefit of the laws. But I'm saying everything else in the system can be disrupted and will be disrupted over time too. Like let's say the Visa network or, you know, Fed buildings, you might not need all this stuff eventually. So I don't want to compare it to what's happening today, but I'm just saying hypothetically, you have a, you know, national digital currency, centralized. Wouldn't that be fundamentally, inherently more efficient? But again, I don't want to say it's better. I'm just saying more efficient because it will have its downsides too. So, I mean, can you at least enlighten us on the efficiencies?
Yeah, I think efficiency is a bit of a loaded term here. I mean, like if we want to look at every piece of energy consumption, it's like, well, what shows do you watch on Netflix? And then I can start evaluating how efficient you are with your Netflix consumption. What food do you eat? Do you eat hamburgers? I think you're using too much energy. We could look at how much soap you use. We could look at your car that you drive. Do you drive a Tesla or not a Tesla? Well, actually, Tesla batteries require a lot of energy consumption to create Tesla batteries. So energy consumption inherently is not a bad thing. just to zoom out, just to provide some perspective here, our entire economy, our entire world, based on the laws of thermodynamics, are governed by energy. Everything is energy in this universe. Energy consumption is not inherently good or bad. And the subjectivity over, like, is this a good use of energy or not, is also pretty out there in terms of, like, very subjective. For example, like, no one criticizes anyone's Netflix consumption and whatnot. And when it comes to money, an obsession over being as efficient as possible isn't really a rabbit hole that makes too much sense. Because if we start to calculate all the efficiencies that Bitcoin unlocks, that's the only way to balance the equation of, like, cost benefit. We can isolate Bitcoin's cost in terms of how much energy it consumes, and we can do a good guesstimate over an existing financial system or a new one in the future. But then we also look at the benefit, and the benefits are huge as well. I think there's just, like, a really deep rabbit hole we could go down around a lot of nuance of, like, well, how valuable is Bitcoin? Is it, you know, for a lot of folks, people are like, this is, like, me, we think it's groundbreaking, and others don't really like it that much. So they don't like the energy consumption aspect. I don't like the Kardashians, but I respect people's ability to pay electricity for something and watch whatever they want. Same with Bitcoin. Bitcoin miners have purchased the electricity just like any one of us have done. You and I have purchased the electricity to be on this call right now. No one has the moral authority to tell us what is a good or bad use case of electricity due to how the market mechanism works of us purchasing it and using it for whatever we'd like. And typically in a capitalist system, we allocate that effectively. I'm free to waste a ton of electricity, but it doesn't make too much sense for a Bitcoin miner to waste electricity unless they're being compensated by the network to do so. And the network of hodlers, buyers, and believers are compensating them to protect the network. So it's a very synergistic relationship between Bitcoin's energy consumption, value generation, and protecting the network.
Mm-hmm. I want to move on into this concept of store of value. We have a world where we seem to be transitioning increasingly into where the velocity of how we use money seems to be kind of increasing and speeding up. And I mean, if I can explain, you know, what's the point of dollars? You know, it's like back in the day, you might, you know, want to save a bunch and, like, but in today's world, like today's kids growing up, they're not saving dollars. You know what I'm saying? They're just sticking it. They're just quickly using it. They have things to put it to use, right? They're exchanging it. They're sticking it into their video game, you know, currencies or buying stuff or whatever. And it seems like as this progression increases over time, let's say 10 years, 20 years down the road, it seems like the concept that we have of money radically changes, where before you had this interface of money where you had the end use of money, for example, to buy stuff and to use it to move it around. And then you have this foundational layer of money, which is more of this real assets or hard assets, things like businesses, companies, stocks, real estate, collectibles, you know, precious metals, all this stuff. And you had this intermediary that had a role because there wasn't this quick velocity back and forth from the real assets into the actual usage or application. However, in the next 10 or 20 years, it seems pretty evident or pretty inevitable in some ways where people are going to be able to take their hard assets of real estate, stocks, collectibles, you know, precious metals, whatever you call it, and quickly exchange it and move it into not the middle layer, but into the final layer of actually paying for goods and services. So it seems like our entire concept and construct of money is changing. It seems like this is the tailwinds of what's going on. When you look at it in this picture, what's the point of Bitcoin? Because Bitcoin, a lot of people say, hey, it's a better digital gold, but digital gold is kind of like that intermediary thing where you kind of, you know, need something to keep in store of value. But why do you need that if you can just go directly from let's say an income producing real estate or stock or something into, you know, buying my coffee? Why do I need this intermediary kind of so-called gold or store of value?
Yeah, because every other asset out there has a risk built into it. So Bitcoin is the only risk-free asset. And the way that we look at the traditional financial world, we would call these treasuries or government bonds are the only risk-free yield out there. And essentially, that's what Bitcoin, treasuries and gold represent, this risk-free layer to the financial system. You are correct. In the very late stages of Bitcoin's adoption, like let's say when Bitcoin hits $1 million to $10 million a coin, very hypothetical, but if Bitcoin achieves its purpose, it should hit a price between those two points. as because that's representative of the market cap of gold plus other stores of value. When it reaches that, Bitcoin will be just as boring as your grandfather's gold. You're like, okay, grandpa, I don't care about gold. You know, congrats, you get 1% of your return on that. That's what Bitcoin will be in its final stages. It's supposed to be the risk-free asset. Bitcoin has no risk because it does not have any operational risk or any sort of like custodial risk. For example, with my real estate, I've got maintenance costs. I have homeowner's insurance. I have other risks in terms of like, earthquakes, changing sentiment and whatnot. The base layer of the financial system should have a trustless asset, a cash-like instrument, a store of value instrument, which is Bitcoin. So the way that the economy would work in the future is that right now, whenever people feel risk off, they sell the riskier assets and move the money into less risky assets. And that's what Bitcoin represents, as the least risky asset on the stack of risk. And so Bitcoin acts as an equilibrating function between the risk off and risk on attitude of the macro environment. So in the future, you would imagine post Bitcoin becoming a world reserve currency or the gold 2.0, the world is in a bull market. Bitcoin would start probably drop in value as people sell off Bitcoin because it's the least risky thing and put it into more risky assets like stocks, bonds, and homes. Then there's a moment when there's been too much lending that has occurred, just like every other bubble in human history, too much lending, too much speculation, and there's a little bit of a dip. Then the money flows back into Bitcoin, Bitcoin's value rises. So what Bitcoin acts as is an equalizer to make sure that the economy doesn't become too distorted with that risk return profile. Right now, with central banks and governments controlling all money other than gold, they have been totally disconnected from any sort of fundamental ability to manage risk. And Bitcoin brings that introduction of properly managed risk and managing risk reward in a decentralized fashion back into the markets in a similar function to how gold did. Previously, governments would never be able to print too much money because they would have to back their fiat by gold. This was a good restrictive function to ensure that governments didn't inflate, you know, like the German marks, where people were stacking German marks to use it for currency, and same in Venezuela currently. Gold acted as the risk-free asset that was the sort of base equalizer for the financial system. And Bitcoin very much fits that in that regard. The price fluctuates a lot right now because Bitcoin's going from, again, one person in the whole world coming up with it, Satoshi, all the way to being globally recognized as that gold 2.0. So volatility was going to be a part of that path.
Do you think it's also volatility is related to Bitcoin being maybe a bit too deflationary? And what I mean by that is, you know, Elon Musk made a comment. He's like, you know, hey, maybe Bitcoin is deflationary to a fault. And obviously you could take that in different angles, but you could say, you know, and that's one of the reasons with Dogecoin, he's like, hey, at least it increases, you know, maybe not as fast as some other things, but there is some element of inflation baked into it. Meaning, when you look at Bitcoin, because it's just, they're not making enough of it. And I think, could there be some part of it where it's inherently volatile, meaning there is a speculative aspect to Bitcoin where people don't look at it as just money. They're looking at it as investment, as speculation, as something that can go up because of its rarity, its scarcity, right? And not just normal scarcity, but scarcity, perhaps extreme scarcity, right? That actually encourages speculation and, you know, all this stuff.
Very, very good question. And there's a couple of things to unpack here. One, you know, I think Elon's quotes around Dogecoin and the inflationary versus deflationary comes across a little trolly in the context. I think he's somewhat making fun of it. I think Elon definitely knows that Dogecoin is not going to be the money of the future. So I think he's doing that a little bit of humor, but I think it does prompt a good question. Is Bitcoin too deflationary? What's really cool about Bitcoin, and my background is in product and marketing. So I currently run Growth at Kraken, a big cryptocurrency exchange, and Growth in my function is user acquisition. Now, Satoshi created this new money and he published this white paper and distributed it as a marketing message to the only people interested. But how do you bake in user acquisition? How do you get people to believe in this new money? He baked in a viral loop. So many people have heard the term going viral from different social media platforms, like, oh, this tweet went viral. Well, a viral loop in marketing is where, for example, you take a ride in an Uber inside the Uber app, there's a button to share the Uber app with your friends. They get $5 off their ride. You get $5 off your ride. That's called a referral. Then that referral might share it with their friends. And so that's the viral loop. The K factor is the indicative factor of the amount of virality it has. How much infectiousness does it have? Satoshi baked into the Bitcoin protocol through this 21 million hard cap. Now, he architected the 21 million hard cap for a couple of reasons, but I'll touch on this one first. The 21 million hard cap from a virality standpoint is huge. Before Bitcoin was worth a penny, Satoshi almost said this directly, and he said, you know, he hypothesizes as Bitcoin's value rises, people become more aware of it. As people become more aware of it, they buy in an expectation of the price increasing, which then brings in more believers who then drive the price higher, which then drives in more adopters, et cetera. The short form version of this is come for the speculation, stay for the digital gold. And that has grown Bitcoin from basically a bunch of people, like a dozen people, to 100 million plus. So it was a very effective marketing message, is tapping into that core human emotion of greed. And that's where Bitcoin does that so brilliantly. Now, the 21 million hard cap, there's a fixed supply, and when demand increases, there's no supply response. Now, if demand for gold surged like it does for Bitcoin, they can go dig gold out of deeper and deeper, deeper mines. But Bitcoin doesn't have that function. There's no supply response in conjunction with demand. And so that acts as a viral loop. There's also a couple other reasons why Satoshi chose the 21 million hard cap. The inherent problem with all monetary policy is the inflation rate. So what is an appropriate rate of inflation? 1%, 2%, 10%? For some reason, central banks have picked 2% as the magical rounded number that supposedly is the perfect rate of inflation. Why not 2.125%? Exactly 2%? Interesting. Seems like a little bit of a human bias just to be like, yeah, we know what you're doing, 2%. Inflation inherently opens up a political attack vector to always talk about what is the appropriate amount of money to make. With that, there are subjectivities like COVID, where we go, we need to help people. We need to print more money. There could be, we need to print more money for more jobs during normal markets. There can be all sorts of circumstances as an excuse to print more money. Bitcoin removes that subjectivity from the monetary policy by going, we will never have a rate of inflation. He fixed the problem by setting it to zero, which is a brilliant breakthrough in game theory and economics. I think it'll be the most legendary breakthrough in economics ever created. By instead of trying to manage the supply in conjunction with demand, he keeps supply constant and demand will figure itself out around supply. It's a genius way to remove any, you know, remember, if there's any political attack vector in Bitcoin, that's a centralization issue, which could undermine confidence in the protocol and defeat the entire purpose why Bitcoin is created. So he not only comes up with a way to protect it from political attack vectors, but he also is able to build in a viral loop that grows awareness and adoption. So it's a really beautiful mechanism that I think like a lot of people haven't dug into. Mm. I think it's a groundbreaking revolution in economics. As we're seeing the world wake up to Bitcoin, more and more of the top hedge funds across the world are like, this is huge. A 21 million completely fixed supply is a revolutionary breakthrough. Mm-hmm.
So let's take the other side and think about this. So on the way up, it's like, great, it's this limited supply, it triggers, it's like a emotional trigger for hoarding and greed, right? You want to get a piece of it before it just runs out, or you just, you know, if you're a believer, obviously, in the future or in the asset. And this kind of hoarding, you know, of it saying, oh, it's so limited, right? We got to get a piece, kind of drives some of that, you know, or a lot of that, let's say, you know, price up and demand up. At a certain point in the future, who knows what that point is? Maybe it's 5 years, maybe it's 10 years down the road. Maybe, you know, there's a billion Bitcoin holders or more, who knows? Bitcoin's price is in the stratosphere or the millions, hypothetically. Could you imagine a possibility that this becomes a downfall of Bitcoin as well? Meaning on the, it's like it causes the rise, right? The hoarding and the kind of the fixed zero or the 21 million like hard cap of Bitcoin, the hoarding and the greed, it pushes it up. But at a certain point, it that you run out, meaning the whole movement runs out because it just reaches the top. And at that point, there's nothing holding it back because it's like it's milked the system. It's milked all of the hoarding and the greed. And then people just start dumping it. And then there's another different thing that they're going after. Do you see that as even a slight possibility, even though obviously most Bitcoiners will say that's not a possibility. That's, you know, I don't want to think about that, is whatever. But I mean, what's your take?
Well, Bitcoin has had, we're in our fourth speculative cycle. I'm in my third personally. So I've seen my net worth go up 10 to 100x and down 80% three times. Bitcoin has survived all four speculative bubbles, starting back from 2011 was the first one. 2011, 2013 technically had two, 2017, and now. So Bitcoin has had the free market, which is Bitcoin stays the same. Protocol doesn't change at all. Supply doesn't change at all. And we've got us humans interacting with Bitcoin, us speculating on it, us buying into it, us buying into its value. That has occurred in these large, like four largely bucketed cycles. Bitcoin has done fine. So, you know, just because the cycle might be bigger or it might be a larger magnitude, I don't really think changes the dynamics of Bitcoin. Around the scarcity element, you know, it's kind of a weird thing to conceptualize. A fixed supply. No more could ever be created. It's a little bit unfathomable. I kind of get it, right? Like, it's a little bit scary. You're like, what does this mean? But that's the beauty in it. It's this perfect, precise measuring stick for the economy and economic activity. So think about it this way. Imagine if we had a ruler for a meter that constantly changed to measure outcomes, right? And with money, we do that to measure outcomes of entrepreneurial output. I go start a hot dog stand. If there's no demand for the hot dog stand, I fail. If there is demand for the hot dogs, I succeed. Money is the measuring stick of my output. It's the measuring stick for these entrepreneurial experiments. It's the measuring stick for the economy. And right now we've got this crazy imprecise measuring stick that we can't even perfectly quantify because it's like, it's in fiat and it's in all these different bank accounts. Whereas Bitcoin is this completely transparent ledger with this completely transparent monetary policy that's fixed. It is that new perfect measurement for the economy. It's this brilliantly simple and beautiful way to manage the economy. Whereas before, there's another analogy I like to use, and we'll see if this one makes sense. So right now, the Fed drives the car, which is the economy, the Fed being the central bank. The problem is you can't see into the future. This is an inherent problem for all humans. If I could, I wouldn't be here right now. I'd be on my yacht with my $1 billion that I got through trading. So no one can predict the future. The Fed attempts to predict the future, but what really is happening is they're driving the car, which is the economy, and the front windshield is completely dark, not even a glimmer of light. And they're looking in the rearview mirror using historical data from the road behind them that they can see, which is coming in, by the way, with some latency and a little bit of a patchwork. And they've got the steering wheel in the gas and brake, and they're using that to drive this car, but they're driving blind. And when they press the gas or brake, all of a sudden, you know, they hit the brake and it takes 10 seconds to kick in. Or they hit the gas. I mean, that is literally what's happening with our economies. You've got a blind driver because they can't predict the future. And so they're doing their best guesstimate of what to do. Bitcoin and Satoshi hypothesized, what if we just let the free market handle it? And that's what Bitcoin's 21 million hard cap represents, is we just let the car drive itself. You have no human in the car. The car just feels the road and will drive itself. A little bit scary at first, but it's better than having a blind driver.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What would you say going forward is, in your opinion, the biggest risk for Bitcoin? Are there any existential risks you see for Bitcoin? Or do you just see kind of 100% guaranteed this thing is going to be the biggest thing? What's your take?
Nothing's 100% guaranteed. Mm-hmm. Look, Bitcoin has a lot of risks still baked in. Bitcoin represents a threat to governments across the world and their money. So eventually Bitcoin will have to challenge the authority of governments. It is already doing that, but I don't think governments have woken up to how big of a change this will be. Bitcoin's biggest existential threat is governments, fighting governments. Now, I don't think of it as like a true concern. I think it'll be a big battle and it will be vicious and it won't exactly be pleasant. But think about the other things that Bitcoin, that we can look at historically, that represent Bitcoin's outcome. For example, climate change. All the governments across the world realize it as a threat, but they can't come together to solve the problem. All the governments across the world, most of them, come up together to fight drugs, and over the last 40 years have definitively lost. Bitcoin, in a similar fashion, requires all the governments in the world to act all together, all at once, to solve the problem if Bitcoin starts to threaten them. But that just doesn't make any sense because we haven't seen that done previously. And there's a game theoretical reason why Russia, China, US won't want to work together, or France, Germany, you know, all these countries you'd have to, that are, some of these are enemy countries as well, like Russia, China with the US. There's just no way they're all going to agree to attack this thing that could be a threat to their enemy. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. And Bitcoin represents a great way to undermine trust and confidence in other countries.
I mean, that line of reasoning, it's a bit, I hear this often, it hasn't happened before, or, you know, looking at historical examples of, oh, countries haven't done it before, therefore, you know, they're going to have a hard time doing it in the future. But I mean, I look at, let's take a maybe a different angle where, okay, what's the trajectory of governments cooperating, okay, to do certain things? If you look at some of the stuff happening internationally with money laundering, right, there's, like, if you look at 50 years ago compared to now, oh my gosh, the governments are like best friends working against money laundering, right? They have extensive agreements across borders, and it's like intense. Like, think about what the U.S. is doing with FATCA and their, you know, requirements when you hold money overseas, and how all of these banks and all of these other countries are now required to submit all this documentation for any, you know, U.S. citizen who's holding, you know, just not even that much, right? Money in any bank account. It's become this web of just regulations, and these governments have become, in a sense, compared to 50 years ago, it's mind-blowing the amount of coordination happening. So if you project another, let's say 20, 30 years or whatever out in the future, the trajectory is you have massive collaboration, right, toward things that governments view as existential risk. So when you look at that way, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it just seems as a different angle from what you're looking at as this historical, they haven't done it in the past, so they won't do it in the future. What's your kind of thoughts on that?
Well, that's a very good rebuttal and a very unique way to look at it as well. So I think there's another frame of reference that we can throw in here that might complete the picture a little bit. Mm-hmm. So governments have a high incentive to allow Bitcoin to compete with them because they can tax the constituency that owns it. So, you know, in that regard, I think like it would still be advantageous for them to not want to ban it because they can tax the people who have it in their country. Now, there's also the protection of the Bitcoin network through adoption, through the ownership of it, through skin in the game votes. We have, there's a U.S. senator on the Financial Services Committee in the Senate who has Bitcoin. The wealthiest person in the world owns Bitcoin. Most of the top tech founders own Bitcoin. One of the largest companies in the world, Tesla, owns Bitcoin, and that is probably going to rapidly permeate into other corporate treasuries. If you ban Bitcoin as a country, all of a sudden you might see your local stock market dip 15%. You have millions upon tens or hundreds of millions of people pissed at you. You won't be voted back into office. So Bitcoin, in essence, is kind of like this unstoppable force. They can it's like a glacier. Yeah, you can try to melt it. You can try to chip at it. You can try to like push it over here, push it over there, but it's just going to keep going. And we're seeing that momentum, you know, with Tesla just being enormous. I mean, like these corporations, which, by the way, in my next newsletter topic, this is what I'm writing about. You can't stop Apple, Google, and Facebook. I mean, Facebook has more citizens than every country in the world. Apple and Google are in the hands of more people too. And then like when you look at like Tesla and SpaceX and how Elon perceives governments, these are larger than governments. These companies will become larger than governments, mega corporation style. And people with these corporations and these individuals who own Bitcoin realize that by owning Bitcoin, these governments can try to push you around, but you can just take your money and walk away. This isn't like the old world where they go, hey, Bank of America, freeze all the accounts of all US citizens. Hey, Bank of America, freeze the account of Tesla. In the future, if these corporates hold their Bitcoin in a multi-sig sort of arrangement across multiple geos, yeah, sure, they can try to like arrest the founders of the company, or they can try to penalize them, but they can't seize the money. And money is the core root of all of the existing financial system. So Bitcoin completely re-architects that power dynamic between governments, companies, and citizens. So we kind of have to depend on the way that Bitcoin would be crushed is if it stays super marginalized. So a very small percentage of the population owns it. The government decides to shoot itself in the foot and also sees the inevitable and tries to delay it, but unsuccessfully. So it's ultimately like, it's like trying to fight off a glacier. You're just not going to win. You can try to chip at it and you might stop it for a second, but it's not going to stop in the grand scheme of things, the scheme of things.
Would you say that's a 100% guarantee scenario, or is that, are you saying that's the most likely scenario? Because I could, you know, see that as one of the various scenarios that could, you know, happen or play out. Are you basically saying you don't see any other scenarios of Bitcoin failing against governments?
Let's put it this way. Bitcoiners spend almost all of their time thinking about how Bitcoin is going to die. That is basically the number one hobby of folks in this space. Nothing in life is guaranteed. Nothing in life is 100% certainty. I think it is a very high certainty that Bitcoin survives and thrives. I think earlier on, it had a much higher chance of failure. Bitcoin has survived stages in its development, including a civil war with the Bitcoin Cash hard fork and other early growth kind of issues, to where right now it's never been stronger than it's been in this moment. And it will increasingly get stronger to a point where I think governments won't see it as a threat until it's too late. Also, governments highlighting it as a threat represents their own. Governments are perceived as all powerful. If they all of a sudden say, I'm threatened by this thing, everyone goes, wait, I thought you had complete control over the economy. Yeah. So there's a bit of a flinching moment as well that would be kind of interesting. Now, I think Nassim Taleb has a great quote here, which is like, don't tell me what you think. Show me what's in your portfolio. Full disclosure, I mean, almost 100% of my net worth is in Bitcoin. So I would say like both a disclosure, but also a vote of confidence in my own belief.
Sure.
I'm not just talking about it. It's something that over 8 years I have gotten convicted in. So if it doesn't pan out, I'll certainly lose quite a bit of money. If it does, then I've put my bet where my mouth is.
Do you disclose how much you have at Bitcoin ever?
No, I've never disclosed that. Okay. It's a Bitcoiner thing. We talk in percentages, but not.
Sure. You talk about a fascinating angle here, which is you think that corporations have become more powerful than governments. And I want to actually, you know, think about this and discuss this a bit more. And I think it kind of goes a bit into history, but also a bit philosophy and where things are headed. And we might disagree on even how we view the past, but it seems, you know, in the past, governments have played a role where they've been on the top of the hierarchy in terms of authority and power. And there have been times where there have been good governments, there have been bad governments, there have been small governments, big governments, a variety of governments in different forms or fashion. But it seems like it almost seems like human nature in some ways for humans to gather around and appoint governments, you know, to give governments power and authority over them, you know, to in some fashion, form or fashion. And this seems to be across cultures, across nations, across languages, across time spans, periods, etc., that you have this similar, you know, model that just props up. And it doesn't seem like it's coincidence. It seems like something about humans where when they gather in large numbers, they, you know, they vote people in and whatever, they want to have a government to provide stability and safety. And this concept of humans handing over authority, right, to governments, and these governments taking kind of the top level of hierarchy and authority, has been kind of a historical trend over, you know, many centuries. So are you saying that this trend is being broken right now with corporations being on top of governments? Is that what you're saying, or are you saying something different? Just curious.
I think there's like two different things to splice out here. One is that we're seeing an increasingly decentralized world. So with technology, with the internet, with Bitcoin, what we started to enable was decentralization. And that's a very different dynamic of power. Decentralized networks are almost impossible to kill. Torrenting's a great example of that. Been around for 20 years, hasn't been killed yet by the government. Bitcoin, another great example. And these two are decentralized systems, right?
I mean,
I'll go back to the company part in a second. Yeah. So we've got that as kind of a new fork of governance. I would say BitTorrent and Bitcoin are a form of governance in a way. When we run that code, we agree to the governance mechanisms that govern that decentralized network. You could expand this to other blockchains as well. With companies, I would say that dynamic is changing because both governments and companies solve problems for their customers. Governments don't perceive it that way. They just perceive you as kind of a slave. They're like, well, you were born here and now you're mine. And you're like, great, did I ever sign a contract? They're like, no, but you're not free to leave. And if you did, we'd tax you a lot. Versus a company, which is like, is oriented around solving a problem. So that's where I think what we're seeing is the rise of these mega corporations, is the rise of solving problems on a grand scale, but that people are developing new trust layers with these companies, where these companies are building such groundbreaking technology that it changes lives. Let's put it this way. The government's not creating new technology to make your life better. They're spending a lot of money on a variety of different programs. And this is getting into a little bit more libertarian style talk, and I don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole, but essentially companies solve problems better than governments. And they do that at an increasingly large and increasingly efficient scale. Every medical breakthrough, typically a company throughout hundreds and hundreds of years. Every single technology, typically a company breakthrough. Now, people argue, oh, well, the government, you know, paid to build GPS. Well, sure, but a private company built that, not the government. And also it was like probably built at like 10x the amount of cost that it would take. So I think what we're seeing is this new dynamic of companies becoming so large that, like, for example, their cash balance sheets are larger than the entire reserves of like a large country, or like the market cap of Apple is larger than most GDPs. You know, this is becoming a situation where these companies will be trying to be squeezed by these countries to produce things. Apple and Google are prime examples of this in Europe, where Europe tries to push them around in terms of taxation, XYZ. Eventually, they might start getting into seizing bank accounts. Once they go down that road, Bitcoin becomes an incredibly attractive opportunity for these entities to become even larger and more censorship resistant than the existing sort of structure they have. I mean, these companies typically have thousands of mini substructures, but with Bitcoin, you can truly own that wealth versus like having that wealth a phone call away from being seized.
Mm-hmm. What would you say to someone who says, "Hey, that might be kind of the facade that these corporations are more powerful than countries"? I mean, sure, some smaller countries, you know, obviously, but let's say take the U.S. When push comes to shove, the U.S. can tax 95% or 99% or 100% of Google's revenue. You know, they could do whatever they want with any company. True, but then what if? I mean, they could seize all their assets, right? They could, I mean, and other countries.
Then I will be on the next plane out of the United States because I don't want to create a company in the United States. And sure. So will every tech innovator in Silicon Valley.
Well, like, for example, you know, there have been historic times, even in the U.S., where income tax was taxed at ridiculously crazy rates, but we didn't actually see, you know, people flocking out of the country, right? I'm just saying that is it possible that, I guess the whole question is, are we really at that point that you think it's just going to continue to grow, where country or companies are going to just get more powerful than, let's say, even the U.S.? Like, is there going to be a company more powerful than the U.S.?
I mean, you had Tim Cook tell the FBI to go F themselves.
Do you really think that Apple would, is, I mean...
They did that.
No, but does that really mean that they're more powerful than the U.S.? I'm just curious.
Yeah, and that's what the beauty of encryption is. Encryption is an asymmetrical weapon that you have. The entire power of the U.S. government cannot crack a Bitcoin private key.
You think the entire resources of the U.S. can't pool together to create a supercomputer or massive amounts that's, let's say, 1,000 times more powerful than all of the supercomputers put together in the world to crack Bitcoin, or let's say one key?
Not a single key. That's the beauty of public-private key cryptography.
So I was listening to this Charles Hoskinson from Cardano last night on his live stream. He's saying, hey, there's some people in Israel that, you know, the team of people that if you give them, you know, you know, the, the whole thing of the lost USB, you know, key, where you don't, he have only two tries left, and he's like, hey, there's people in Israel who can crack this, you know, and they can actually prove it. Like, what do you say to that? Is that just false, or?
I mean, Charles has been known in the space to wildly exaggerate certain claims. So, by the way, Bitcoin is protected by the same encryption that the U.S. government uses on all their top secret documentation. So I don't think the NSA or CIA is going to encrypt things that a couple Israelis can crack in their basement. It's encrypted with SHA-256 bit, or AES-256 bit encryption, which is used by the NSA, CIA, and all of the DOD departments to encrypt their classified information. So that information is expected to remain encrypted for at least 20 to 50 years. So they're building for a future where they don't expect computers in the next 50 years to be able to crack one file at a time. Not even considering that you'd have to repeat that process with each file. So the extent of this, by the way, I mean, we're talking such magnitudes that you would need to build a computer like the size of the Earth to perform the cracking operations. Now, that is the core encryption primitive. The software developers building each wallet can accidentally introduce flaws. And maybe that's what Charles is referencing. That should have been the first caveat to that statement, though, of his, would be that this is not a flaw in encryption. This is a flaw in the implementation. Mm-hmm. So those do exist. For example, let's say you have sweat on the keypad, right? And they could maybe reduce the amount of guesses from a trillion years worth of guesses to a million years worth of guesses. That sort of function. But public private key cryptography, which, by the way, I've grabbed lunch with Ralph Merkel, the guy who invented it, underpins everything in this
world. I mean, here I think we have some fundamental, I guess, different views of how we're viewing cryptography right now. My understanding of cryptography is actually that it is a kind of a cat mouse game where, you know, you can make the most amazing key, but it's all about the there is usually and almost always a way to crack that with enough computing power, but the whole basis is no one is going to be able to create that massive amount of computing power realistically for, you know, a realistic cost in the anytime near future, you know, meaning you've made a encryption process that is, if it would cost, you know, tens of billions of dollars or $100 billion to crack, if you wanted to build all the computing power necessary to crack that encryption process. But if there was a motivated player who had hundreds of billions of dollars of resources to create that computing power, that supercomputer to crack it, they could, but it just isn't realistic for that one player to have that motivation. I mean, that's typically my understanding of cryptography, but I mean, I'm more than open to see how I'm wrong with this.
You're directionally correct, but magnitudes off in terms of cost. Mm-hmm. So encryption is underpinned by information theory. Information theory is a core fundamental part of computer science. Information theory is almost actually has a direct parallel track to thermodynamics. So thermodynamics are the core laws of physics that underlie our entire universe. Information theory, encryption, they're all rooted together with physics. You can run these numbers because these are actually physics-based simulations. The amount of effort required, so to put this in sort of magnitude, AES-256 would require a computer the size of the Earth, and it would have to then spend like 10,000 years guessing. That's the size of cost we're talking about here. So yes, you are directionally correct. It is possible given an extremely motivated attacker, which, by the way, 256-bit, you'd make that 512-bit. You can just make it even larger, which would require more guesses, because the only way to crack these is to guess. Because this is based in physics. It's not code. This is actually more based on physics. That's what's so beautiful about it, is that we place our trust in physics, which I'm pretty comfortable with, because the laws of thermodynamics have been around for 150 years. And notice that they're a law, not a theory, like the theory of relativity. So in all computer science, all of our physics are based on these principles, which if these principles weren't correct, we'd see planes falling out of the sky, computers breaking, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So given that, I feel very comfortable in putting my trust in something like AES-256, which is, again, used by every government of the world to protect their information. And they're sort of the canary in the coal mine.
Sure.
They have a lot of money and a lot of motivation to crack it. If they ever felt threatened, they would likely start to change their encryption algorithm because they're worried about their data being compromised, and we don't see them doing that.
Mm-hmm. You said something about, you know, how the governments haven't been able to kill, for example, BitTorrent, so therefore, you know, they aren't good at killing decentralized things, or certain decentralized technologies are, you know, almost impossible to let's say eradicate. What about the angle of BitTorrent doesn't really pose much of a threat to the existential threat to the government? It's not very motivating for the government to go after a, you know, BitTorrent. I mean, it's kind of an example. It's a bit. I mean, I don't know if it's the most pertinent example because it's something that doesn't even matter much to the government. So why would they even, like, you know, it's like, why would they even want to use all this energy? Rather, but when we look at Bitcoin, we're talking about something that's on a completely different level than BitTorrent. You know, this Bitcoin is something that can, in some form or fashion in the future, really be a threat. And it could be seen as existential to the governments, let's say, various abilities to control money supply, for taxation, for, you know, different control, the power of the government, you know, in some ways can be threatened. Do you still think the government just can't, I'm not going to say governments can't completely destroy it, obviously, but can they make it very difficult for Bitcoin? Meaning, can they ban transactions in their country and all their partner countries? Can they ban the on-ramp, off-ramps? Can they make it illegal to even hold the currency, where you can go to jail if you actually are found out later and they actually go after people? Are there ways to make it difficult even without killing it off completely?
Oh, totally. Yeah, totally. And they have increased the amount of regulations around it to where it's like a frog in a pot of boiling water, right? Like, at what point does it become boiling? You know, so totally agree that there are a lot of ways that governments can make it tough. And I think your criticism is very fair. I didn't give you any good example of something that directly threatens their sovereignty. So that's a very, very fair point. Maybe another one might be like the banning of gold. Gold was banned in the US back in the 1930s. And it was banned because the government perceived it as a threat. Now, gold usage in terms of ownership didn't change too much. People didn't turn in their gold because everyone had gold. It was considered widely ridiculous. The price of gold surged, and gold across the world wasn't changed. Other countries did not ban it like the US did. So that, I think, is maybe a more apt example when I give it a little bit more thought, because you were right. I don't think the ones I gave you were the best. Now, I don't think I'm going to have a clear-cut, perfect example for you, though. I mean, that is like clearly threatening to all governments. I mean, but gold, I think, is a good one.
I mean, the gold one to me is just—it's not that threatening if some people have some gold in their houses. It's not going to like crash. Like, it's not going to ruin the whole U.S. There's a level of, you know, the U.S.
They were threatened by it because of the government policy. I mean, gold ownership at the time, very high.
But the way I look at it is there's various degrees of which a government chooses. Like, there's many laws banning many, many different things. It's not that the government is really serious on completely eradicating certain things, you know? There's many, many laws, and most of the things are very permissive, actually, you know? Even if they still call ban, they're not going to do a death penalty. No one got the electric chair for holding one gold coin. You know, it wasn't that important. I mean, I've heard examples of people saying, "Oh, prohibition, you know, the government couldn't, you know, ban alcohol." I'm like, alcohol, it's like, come on. It's like the government's not trying to put everyone in the electric chair for, you know, taking a sip of drink. I think a better example is maybe spy, espionage, you know, where it's more directly correlated to the existential threat of the country. It's a national security. I think that's what, I'm not going to say it's guaranteed, but Bitcoin at a certain point possibly could get such a threat to governments where they view it as kind of a national security level threat. And the way that, for example, governments go after, you know, traitors, espionage, like stuff like this, like that stuff is on a different scale. This is not, you know, like hiding gold coins or alcohol, you know, this is pretty serious stuff. What are your thoughts?
Well, money underlies the entire sanctity of the government. If the government doesn't have control over the money, nor control to pay their troops or pay anyone in the government, then they're not a government. So money underpins all that. I would say that gold was a good example of an existential threat to the sovereignty of the United States. That's why they banned it. But I get where you're coming from. Like, let's take it up another level. Mm-hmm. If we take it up another level, I mean, you're not living in a free country anymore if your government's going door to door and shooting you for owning something that you bought in private that's not harming anyone else. Like at that stage, we're reaching a point where like you've got widespread looting, you've got widespread insurgencies going on that are local because you've got governments that are cracking down on basic freedom of speech issues. I mean, Bitcoin at the end of the day is just code, and as we saw with Cody Wilson and his 3D printed gun plans, the federal U.S. courts overturned the Department of Defense's objections to having those gun plans online because they said it's a freedom of speech issue. At the core end of the day, if they start knocking down our doors, trying to seize our Bitcoin and shooting us for it, well, then fuck yeah, we're all going to shoot back, because at that point, we don't live in the United States anymore. We live in like Soviet Russia. And at that point, I'm willing to fight for my freedom. So I don't think we come to that. I think that's a very unlikely circumstance. And the government, again, is comprised of all of us. We all vote to give the government power. If a large portion of citizens own Bitcoin, care about it, then the government inherently partially cares about it. And if people in the government own it, good luck having soldiers or policemen knocking door to door when they own Bitcoin themselves. You know, it's kind of like the Second Amendment stuff. I find it very improbable that, for example, I'm from Texas. I find it very improbable that that they could order like troops or policemen who are very avid gun owners to go enforce this anti-gun policy like door to door. You know, for folks who, by the way, in the people who are friends of armed service members and policemen, they typically all have guns too. So I find it a little bit improbable that the enforcement of this would be done by people that own it, and the people that own it and don't like the enforcement of it would just roll over. There's a lot of kind of like, we're making a lot of assumptions. I do agree that sure, some country may try that. No doubt some country will. I don't think the United States will, based on the kind of core fundamental principles of who we represent. I see a country more like China or Russia trying to do that. But again, you can't stop an idea whose time has come, and that Bitcoin's idea and its time has come. And there are ways to attack it, but that way would be particularly detrimental and kind of signal the end of whatever government that may be.
Mm-hmm. You said earlier in our discussion something I wanted to go back to, because I think it could be misunderstood, but you said something about Bitcoin being the only risk-free asset. And I think I want to go back to that, because I think that could be misunderstood, because obviously in some ways, a lot of ways, Bitcoin is not risk-free, meaning it's a very risky asset. You know, like I'm going to put all my net assets in there and think that it's risk-free because someone said it's risk-free, but it's volatile, very, very volatile. So is that the right point? I mean, two things. One is what's your aim in saying that? But second, is there a better terminology to use? Because just saying Bitcoin is risk-free, I don't think that perhaps is what the end goal maybe that you're wanting.
I mean, that's a very good to circle back on this. I think I'm using some of my internal finance jargon, which is probably lost on the audience, and my apologies for that. So when I say risk-free, what that means is that there is no inherent risk baked into the operation of Bitcoin in terms of like an income generation event. So for example, holding gold has no inherent operational risk. When you hold gold, you don't have to worry about gold not going out and, for example, like with my equity, I have to worry about the company not building a product or service very well. If I buy Apple equity, I am taking on the risk and also the potential return, but the risk that they don't deliver an iPhone and then the revenues drop. With bonds, same sort of thing. The company has been lent money and we hope that the company pays it back. So that's the risk. And then with gold and what people, and this is what the local finance jargon is, risk-free asset or like the risk-free yield for treasury bonds. These are the least risky elements these are the least risky assets you can hold on the risk stack. So the risk stack would be like lower levels of risk, higher levels of risk. This is the lowest you can go in terms of risk. So it's technically not risk-free. There are all sorts of issues. Like for example, with gold, we could find an asteroid with a ton of gold on it. That makes holding gold very risky because the supply now increased 3x. Same with Bitcoin. Bitcoin could have a flaw in it, which is very improbable, but Bitcoin could have a flaw in it. Or Bitcoin is successfully attacked by a government. All governments across the world come together to attack it. But Bitcoin does not have any risk baked into itself in terms of it having to perform a function other than just continuing to run. Just like how gold, just as long as gold just exists, that's its risk. There's no risk baked into like gold being like, gold doesn't have to be used for something else in order to generate value. It just exists as value.
I mean, when I hear risk-free asset, I'm thinking more of something that, I'm guaranteed that back, right? That's not what you mean. Is that correct? Are you talking about you're talking about absence of what you call operational risk? Is that what you're saying?
Precisely. With Bitcoin, you trust in math. With gold, you trust in physics and the periodic table. If those were tampered with, if the Bitcoin core code, we all decided to raise the amount of Bitcoin created, which is not going to happen. But if that did happen, that would be, for example, that would undermine confidence and that would now introduce risk into it. Same with gold. If we were able to turn lead into gold in an efficient manner, that would make gold much less valuable. So in terms of, risk-free, I think is a bad misnomer. And I think that's a great way for me to recalibrate my thinking. At Kraken, I'm always trying to think of how we communicate to our customers. And sometimes we get so deep down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, we kind of forget that these terms can come across a little esoteric for folks. So Bitcoin is not a risk. It'll be clear to everyone listening, Bitcoin has risk when you buy it. Like when you buy Bitcoin, you're taking on a certain amount of risk. Yeah. The term risk-free is a finance term.
But even a finance term, it doesn't seem like it's appropriately, applied here. When you're looking at an investment, if you say it's just a risk-free asset, you're talking about, it's pretty much guaranteed without loss. I mean, I don't know if you're really applying risk-free, that language, to an asset to classify it as having absence of operational risk. It's a little bit, I don't know, it seems like a cross-application of a term to an asset that might, I don't know, it seems a bit misapplied. Just some feedback but to think about.
Sure.
Yeah.
No, I appreciate it. I mean, I don't know, how would you define gold then?
What do you mean? In terms of?
In terms of risk profile.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't call it risk-free per se, obviously, because there's a volatility to gold. I think the main point you're saying though is this whole operational risk. Let's say a company, what if Elon Musk dies? Like, what happens to Tesla, right? Or SpaceX? There's operational risk, even with Google or Apple. There's with real estate, what if your house blows up, or you have just infestation of mold that just, there's so many operational risks, let's say with typical assets. So I think what I'm getting is the main point is you're saying, with gold or with Bitcoin, you don't have that operational risk in terms of, of the ongoing, operations, that give the company or the asset value. But it seems though it's a little bit minimizing some of the operational risks of Bitcoin. Like for example, is there some operational risk where there could be a 51%, hypothetically, theoretically, a 51%, attack on Bitcoin because it's based on the proof of work system? Like, are you saying there's no operational risk at all with Bitcoin, or are you just saying it's minimal?
So 51% attacks can occur with proof of stake or proof of work chains. Those don't change. Both of them have a block reward, and that block reward can be compromised, and a certain number of attackers can utilize. And proof of stake systems also have slashing mechanisms that are very complicated and otherwise to minimize game theoretic risk. But proof of work is not the only chain that is subjected to this. When it comes to, saying like risk-free, again, that's a more finance term. We could debate as to like how appropriately it is applied to Bitcoin. When it comes to operational risk, Bitcoin has operated extremely stably over the last 12 years in terms of the amount of like changes or any sort of errors. Yes, there are let's put it this way. Given how the core code has been constructed and the folks, all the Bitcoin believers who believe in it, that sort of game theoretic incentive and structure seems very, very sound from a risk perspective. Now, if there was something unexpected, for example, like an alien species comes down and can crack AES-256. Sure, that is something that is a risk. That is like such a large tail risk that we can largely bucket that as like almost risk-free or very low risk or very, very low operational risk. So yes, I think it is a little bit of a misnomer to say risk-free, but it is a degree of risk-free that or risk less or an extremely low level of risk that these error states or very, 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 very improbable states become increasingly less likely, so unlikely that, again, it's not part of the operation of the protocol. It's not contingent upon these risks being developed on. It's yes, those are like one out of a quadrillion chance, sort of like tiny, tiny probability.
Okay, so let's take a little slight different angle on this. What if, couldn't you say like demand and belief, kind of this, how much people want Bitcoin is, it seems like you can't separate that from Bitcoin itself. Like it seems there's something very joined together with the belief in Bitcoin, the demand for Bitcoin and the price of Bitcoin, right? This, how people value that scarcity. And what I'm getting at is, you know, sure, maybe there's low technical operational risk with Bitcoin, but then if you look at more of the, what the essence of Bitcoin is, it's part technical in a sense, right, with blockchain, but then it also is part demand and belief. You know, there, it's not just a simple code thing. It's, and that's why some people might even compare it to, there's like a religious type of, I wouldn't say it's a religion by any means, but I'm just saying there is something about believing in something and its future and what it represents that's larger than just something menial, you know? And when I look at Bitcoin, it's like part technical, and I could say, okay, low operational technical risk, I agree. But part of Bitcoin is belief and is demand. Isn't that high risk in some ways? Like it can go up and down in different ways next year, this year, you know? And we've seen volatility in the past and likely see it in the future. So Bitcoin, like, I don't know, I could see it technically, operationally low risk, but, you know, it's a very volatile asset. I don't know. It seems like to pull risk out of Bitcoin doesn't give justice to what Bitcoin is. Bitcoin is inherently, you know, it's I wouldn't say risky in a negative sense. It's just what it is. You know, it's unknown exactly the full extent of the future where it's headed.
I think the human angle is such an interesting one. Like blockchains and Bitcoin are far beyond just code. It's this intertwined nature of code, game theory, physics. It's wild, and that's why most people get kind of eyes glazed over when you say the word blockchain or Bitcoin. And so when it comes to the human element, I do think that you've highlighted on one thing that is the biggest kind of like part of all this, is that it doesn't matter what technology or products or software we build, humans have to interact with it. You know, that's ultimately what gives value or breathes life into anything. And in terms of like, you know, Bitcoin's risk on like, will people believe in it? I think people will choose to want to preserve value. I think Bitcoin would die if humans in aggregate said, I don't want to preserve value. I don't care about preserving my value. People are free to take whatever value of mine away from me. And I don't care about being able to send it to anyone I want. I think at the fundamental nature, Bitcoin would die if the world woke up and everyone said, I don't care about storing value, which it goes against human nature, because humans, you know, we're barely a veneer of civilization here. Give us, you know, no water and food for a couple of days and we'll do just about anything. So you take that away, and ultimately, like, humans are about resource allocation, and money is just a scoreboard mechanism to allocate resources. The preservation and storage of people's value. And by the way, money is also like a great representation of time and energy. I spent time and energy to earn this money. And that number, that unit is a representation of it. And I could take that and I can use that money to buy food and energy and pay people to do things for me. So money is kind of like a weird kind of energy, time, money in a way. It's a representative value of that. So for people in aggregate to stop caring about preserving their time and energy, I think would be a very unlikely scenario. But in that scenario, I see, like, if people in mass lose faith in Bitcoin and don't care at all about Bitcoin in the slightest, then certainly I think Bitcoin would in that case die. Like Bitcoin, if humans stop being humans, then Bitcoin dies, is kind of what I'm saying.
Sure. I mean, that's the extreme example, but probably a more kind of variable example is the success or of Bitcoin is dependent on demand, right? On belief and demand, and how successful, or in different ways, how you quantify that. But let's say how Bitcoin can grow in the future all depends on the demand, because the supply is fixed, right? So you have supply and demand. If supply is fixed, it's all about demand. And there could be variable levels of that demand over time, right? Meaning whether it's, you know, I don't know. I mean, that's obviously up to each person to decide. I mean, when you look at other blockchains, for example, I mean, another question with kind of risk with Bitcoin, like a lot of people will say, hey, look at Bitcoin, it survived, you know, many, many different, you know, attempts from other blockchains and technologies, you know, but it survived. But when I look at that, I'm like, wait a minute, this is just, I mean, this is just, you know, we're talking just about a decade or, you know, Bitcoin, what started, what, 2009 or so, but it didn't really catch on more until, you know, several years later. But I'm talking, we don't have decades of, you know, of experience with this. We're just talking about a very, very short time. It's almost like, you know, just because nothing has taken out the iPhone in the past 10 years means that nothing will take out the iPhone in the next 20 years. Like, that's a pretty big jump, you know, to say that, because obviously you can't project the past into the future, especially with technology and
Sure.
competition. And so with Bitcoin, like, is it a risk that other blockchains come up, let's say 20 years down the road, you know, that are just far superior and that has a completely different approach? I know Bitcoiners say, oh, then, you know, they'll incorporate that technology or people, you know, different things. But what if, you know, the founders or the blockchain doesn't? It's and that's how usually innovation happens, you know, over time. There's a financial reward to create something different. That's not, you know, you don't want to just merge. You know, Google doesn't want to merge with Yahoo in 2000, right? They want to create their own company. I mean, what do you think about that? Is that a potential risk?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack here. So one is that Bitcoin's through its really unique monetary policy that we talked about, the 21 million hard cap, that is the shelling point for folks to store value in it. Shelling point means the central point of collection, the network effect behind it. So the amount of money and the amount of folks that believe in Bitcoin is higher than every other chain combined. So that network effect, as we've seen with other social media networks, is a very critical function. Now, do other crypto networks have those network effects? Yes, some do. Especially like Ethereum would be one of the larger ones. And with Bitcoin and money, this isn't just the switching cost of switching from Friendster to MySpace to Facebook, which, by the way, kind of random aside, to kind of lighten it up a little bit. The founder of MySpace follows me on Twitter for some reason, Tom.
Nice, nice.
Tom follows me on my. I was like, oh, this is pretty random. He liked one of my tweets, and I'm like, is this really Tom? Anyways, so the social media networks, you could easily hop between them because there was no switching costs. When you store value in Bitcoin's ledger, there's a tremendous amount of switching costs to switch over to another one. Sure, the transaction is pretty instant, but for example, you incur capital gains. There's all sorts of like, you have to like lose faith in Bitcoin and switch over to this other one. So you must completely destroy your faith in Bitcoin and build up your faith in this other cryptocurrency. So, or crypto asset, whatever you'd like to call it. So I think like there's a lot of stuff to unpack. One, the network effect. Bitcoin has the largest, it's had the largest persistent one. That network effect builds liquidity, builds the amount of adoption, which grows the price, which allows larger and larger market participants coming in. Hence why no treasury is buying ETH. No hedge fund is buying ETH. No major hedge fund. They're all buying Bitcoin because Bitcoin's market cap, belief in it are the largest. And I think that's where people don't really understand like how time builds trust, how the Lindy effect truly occurs. This is a finance, like a more finance-oriented thing where people trust these institutions because of time. That's what Ethereum doesn't understand, is they're like, well, we can replace all trust with code. And it's not just code. There's humans that are involved with this loop, and humans in our animal nature need time to build trust. Bitcoin has had a lot of time to build trust. So even when Ethereum switches to proof of stake, it requires everyone to watch and wait to see how secure proof of stake is versus proof of work, which has been chugging along for 12 years now. So it's not that it isn't cool tech. It's not that there isn't some interesting ideas behind it. You are trying to replace money as a trust-based system. People are storing this trust in Bitcoin's ledger. That ledger is growing larger and larger. More and more people are placing trust in it. And more and more pedigreed folks, that's a runaway sort of event where you now, that adoption curve of Bitcoin in terms of percentage ownership across the world reaches a huge inflection point. And that's something you really can't fight. And so these other cryptocurrencies or crypto protocols, whatever you want to call them, I think they would have a very hard chance of overcoming that Lindy effect, that time effect, that stability effect. Time builds trust. Bitcoin has been the rock bottom set of trust from both a decentralization standpoint to surviving civil war, to having Satoshi walk away, to not having any sort of pre-mine. All of these things build trust in Bitcoin. And that's a time built function. And Bitcoin's is the only one that has had that. Now, will other coins go up and down? Sure. Will other coins be created? Yes. I've been around for 8 years and I've seen 10,000 cryptocurrencies come and go. None of them have ever taken over Bitcoin. And so I think, yes, 10 years is a somewhat short amount of time. In the physical human world, we have lifespans that are typically in the 80s, you know, 80 plus years now. But in terms of technology, that's very fast. 10 years ago, we didn't have Uber sort of thing, or like Uber was just being created. We didn't have smartphones, you know, or we just started to get smartphones. Like this was a long time ago. So I think that, you know, with the internet allows ideas and money and the transfer of that to happen at a very fast rate versus before with like paper and physical items, ideas couldn't be transferred that quickly. So the fleshing out of if Bitcoin is the final money, or is it Bitcoin the winner, has occurred on like think about it like a champion, like Bitcoin battles each coin, has rotated through so many so quickly that I find it very improbable that a new one comes up that has some sort of parameters that people would completely lose their faith in Bitcoin for to switch over.
Why do people completely have to lose their faith in Bitcoin? Can it be gradual where they do up to 10% in ETH, 90% of Bitcoin over time, they go, hey, I now have 60%, not just in ETH, but in all these other, you know, tokens, et cetera, you know, and 40% of Bitcoin. And it's a gradual thing.
Certainly. Yeah, it could certainly be a more gradual function where we see that shift over. I don't think like metrics like the dominance metric makes too much sense. Coming from like a product like analytics perspective, you'd want to cohort and volume weight that because, for example, I can add Dancoin. Dancoin could be one coin worth a penny, one coin worth a dollar, and there's a trillion units, and I get you and I to transact one Dancoin, and now there's $1 trillion market cap in crypto, which makes Bitcoin's dominance metrics, Bitcoin's representative market capitalization relative to all the cryptos, drop. So there's metrics that try to quantify this. I think they do that very poorly. I'm actually working with a company right now to do a cohorted liquidity adjusted dominance metric. But the TLDR is over time, we just don't really see Bitcoin's position as a global store of value or like this gold 2.0. We haven't seen that threatened by any good contender. Ethereum is supposed to be a dApp world computer sort of platform, a decentralized or a DeFi product. There's been a couple different narratives. It's pivoted quite a bit. It's kind of hard to keep track of which one, but the latest one is DeFi, decentralized finance. They also try to append their name to the store of value narrative, which is a little bit funky, but it is something that they've pivoted to during the bear market of 2018, 2019. So you could argue that Ethereum is a contender. That even that statement though is contentious. Some people say ETH is not money. Some people insist it's money. I think that's even like very highly debated within the Ethereum community. So Bitcoin as a cryptocurrency, as it being in the store value gold 2.0 category, is unchallenged. It has met challengers, which all have failed, but is unchallenged in terms of, I think, its future expectations. Now, there are some fun game theory we can play out here, which is kind of cool. What if governments go back to the gold standard? A lot of governments have gold reserves. So they could use that as a way to attack Bitcoin, where they go, we don't like this Bitcoin thing, but we all still have gold. Let's go back to gold. I think that's a really fun way to think through how governments might attack Bitcoin in the future. Even with that, though, it would require trust to make it work. I'd have to trust that the gold is in the reserves. I'd have to trust that their auditing was done correctly. Whereas with Bitcoin, I can run a trustless system on my home computer, and I can validate every single Bitcoin transaction, every transaction that has ever occurred, and the monetary policy. So, you know, I think like in terms of the contender space for Bitcoin in the cryptocurrency niche, I just don't see very many coming out. Also, I don't see CBDCs, so central bank digital currencies. These are simply just existing fiat currencies wrapped in a digital layer that doesn't solve the underlying problem of trust. Mm-hmm. So the long answer is I don't see a good contender for Bitcoin. Short answer is, sure, anything can happen, but I find it very highly improbable that a new contender comes out that would so degrade, I think a better terminology, instead of completely lose faith, degrade the faith to such a degree that folks would switch over.
In your argument, you're talking about different reasons for that. One is network effects, and then you went into kind of high switching costs, and then you went into time, building trust. When you look at those things, like, for example, high switching costs, shouldn't it be actually lower switching costs than any other investment out there? Sure, you pay some capital gains taxes, but the ability to switch from one crypto to another is like, I just go to Uniswap or just go to some exchange and I'm able to switch my currency. So, I mean, I'm not completely getting why it would be high switching costs to switch out of Bitcoin to another crypto.
Switching costs are, it's a mental and a costly switching cost, not the actual not the actual conduct of switching from the currencies. That is very simple.
Yeah.
It's the mental and the tax cost and other costs that would be tremendous.
I mean,
you know, you can't constantly switch your mind between different cryptocurrencies. You get slowly eroded by not only exchange fees, but transaction fees, the mental fees of switching your belief system all the time. And finally, like, you know, like at the end of the day, you can't, you know, the switching cost there would be you're abandoning the shilling point aggregate belief system in this money, which has had a runaway belief in it. And you're switching over and you're hoping that everyone else switches. And you've got some sort of the high switching cost comes with, like, how do you change your mind about Bitcoin once you get there? Like,
the thing is, people change their minds all the time about lots of things.
Sure.
You know? They're not locked into one thing for, you know, 50 years, obviously.
Sure. But I think you'll find that a huge portion of Bitcoiners, and by the way, mm-hmm. most folks like Charles Hodgkinson and others mm-hmm. that have these other cryptocurrencies, they hold Bitcoin. Bitcoiners don't hold the altcoins, but even Vitalik owns Bitcoin. So I think back to Nassim Taleb, don't tell me what you think, show me your portfolio is a good indication of how they think through it. We're seeing, like, there's the Bitcoiners who are completely obsessed with Bitcoin and only have Bitcoin. Then you've got, like, the folks who have a mixed bag of different crypto assets, but most of them, say a large portion of them, a big portion of their portfolio is Bitcoin.
I mean, I would have to say probably with some guys like Vitalik or Charles Hodgkinson, they probably hold the vast majority of the assets in ETH or Cardano, ADA, or something else. Small percent, you know, in Bitcoin
They were given to it by the protocol. They gave themselves those coins. Yeah.
Well, sure, but they could have sold it, but they chose to hold on to it. I mean, okay, so mental switch. I mean, I get that, but I mean, just real costs. I mean, talking about, you know, money cost to switch, it doesn't seem like, you know, there's a ton of cost, right? Besides just
capital gains.
But I mean, that's with every investment, right? So there's actually lower cost to switch from Bitcoin to, let's say, ETH or something else, because I could do it so fast. I don't have to sell my house, which takes like months, and pay all these commissions.
You're talking about the actual physical. Yeah, I don't disagree with that at all. And that's not my intention. I think I was trying to clarify that earlier, where, like, I'm not talking about the actual mechanism of switching. It's the mental and costliness of, like, changing your mind that often, switching to this new protocol and switching back and forth, which, by the way, is it ETH? Is it ADA? Is it XRP? Is it Tron? I mean, these narratives ebb and flow often. I mean, Ethereum, back when I first heard about it, I mean, I got a couple of buddies who worked on, like, part of the core team, and you got to remember that, like, people didn't really believe in that. It was largely considered to be a niche group. And for example, like at Satoshi Roundtable 2015, you know, they was very much kind of a niche thing. We didn't know if they were going to be the next Counterparty, which no one's ever heard of Counterparty, right? So, you know, with all of these, there's an ebb and flow of belief and narrative. As the price goes higher, people believe in it. I mean, that's the thing, is, like, with ADA and Tron, like with XRP, like, XRP wasn't exactly the shining example of decentralization out there, but it still had a huge belief system. So belief systems drive a lot of the perceived value, which then drives more interest. Prices are the signal that bring in people. Price goes higher, people become aware of it. You know, the cost, like, mental cost of switching your paradigm shift all the time. Like, people don't just wake up and go, like, most people, if they choose to be atheist, you know, or they believe in a religion, I think that's a gradual thing, right? Like, you don't just wake up and go, boom, I'm done. Yeah, there might be an aha moment for some people. Same with government money. So when you finally reject your local government money, like the dollars, euros, and you go, I want to go into cryptocurrency, you know, Bitcoin is the longest lasting, and it has the largest network effect, the most number of people in it, and has, I think the most sound reasoning over what problem it's solving. It's solving the problem of trust. It's being a store of value. These other cryptocurrencies have pinned themselves to various other narratives. I mean, Ethereum's narrative has pivoted many, many times. It was a dApp platform, so decentralized apps. It was decentralized finance currently. Radical finance was one. Store of value. So to mentally switch and store your value in a new cryptocurrency, you have to believe in the narrative that they're crafting that is appended to the cryptocurrency. And with most of these, they switch all the time, and you won't be able to, you know, you keep switching between them, of like, XRP, it's good for banks. Litecoin, it's a faster Bitcoin. I mean, and some of these are objectively wrong. There's no such thing as a faster proof of work cryptocurrency. That's just the narrative, right? So when you switch, you have to switch to some of these. One, you'd have to completely misunderstand what Bitcoin, how it works. You'd also have to buy into what I would, some of these I would say isn't correct marketing of how it actually functions. So what I mean by switching costs is that, like, you have to constantly change your mind and totally undermine your entire thinking. If you really understand Bitcoin, I found very few people who actually understand Bitcoin, like really understand it, go and switch and start to store a huge amount of their value in something else. Mm-hmm. I find that to be a rare circumstance.
You're saying that you find very few people who really, understand Bitcoin, or...
Yeah, I would say people who fundamentally understand how it works, the game theory, the scarcity element, the 21 million hard cap, why that's valuable. Now, I do think people do understand that and then choose to speculate with other things and earn a return or try to trade and time the market. Mm-hmm. But I think that, overall, I think like a lot of people who've come to understand Bitcoin's value and understand it. For example, here's one that's more outside of the cryptocurrency space.
Yeah.
Once you've gone from fiat to Bitcoin, almost no one ever goes back. Almost sure. no one's ever like, oh, I understand Bitcoin. I want my dollars again.
So let's say someone goes from fiat to believing in Bitcoin. They put all their assets in Bitcoin and then they moved over and they put 70% of their assets into ETH or other stuff, but they kept 30 in Bitcoin. Are you saying that that person doesn't really understand Bitcoin?
No, what I'm saying is that I find it rare where people really grok Bitcoin to where they want to switch. Now, I'm not saying that they don't understand Bitcoin. I'm just saying that it's a rare circumstance in which that occurs. So
who would you say would be the top couple people that you think really capture the essence of Bitcoin that, you know, people should, you know, listen to, or at least, you know, pay attention to?
I would say Nick Carter. Nick Carter is a pretty neutral sort of individual who really, really understands the nuances, fundamentals of a lot of these coins. He also writes about some of the DeFi stuff as well. And Hasu. Hasu is a researcher at Deribit. Deribit is another exchange in the space. Hasu is really tries to strive to be neutral. So even though I disagree with him with things, I think he's got some great perspectives. He's probably the most neutral researcher I've ever seen. He's also great at writing. So there's not only understanding it, but distilling it down to its essence. And so Hasu does a great job of that, and same with Nick Carter.
Awesome. Yeah, I had a great time getting to know Nick. We had like a 3-hour interview, actually.
Oh, wow.
He was a smart guy.
He's like the crypto academic. You know,
he's
going to teach a Harvard course someday on it, I bet.
Yeah, I really appreciated him, his points. So a question from a Twitter follower said, have you ever protected your Bitcoin position during the huge market downturns with some form of hedge, like in 2014 or 2018? Obviously without selling your stash, since you'd never do that. If so, how? If not, would you consider it?
Yeah, that's a great question. A couple things to unpack here. One, I would have to know how to time the market, and that's really tricky to do. So I don't know when the market's going to turn down. Historically, we look back and we're like, oh, it seemed obvious. Bitcoin was on a runaway price run up from 10,000 to 20,000. Everyone could feel it. Well, I've been in the moment. It's really hard to know when that's going to happen. So one is timing it, which would be really difficult. Two is the method that you would be able to short it or essentially hedge. So I'm assuming that you'd be long. You would own probably spot. So you'd own the coins. And so you're exposed and you want to minimize your downside exposure. Two ways to do that are to go short. So you borrow the coin. So this would be on, for example, at Kraken, you can go short. So you borrow the coins and through this, you know, I don't want to get into like how shorting works, but essentially you're able to bet that the market will go down. If it continues to go up though, you get short squeezed. This is what happened with GameStop and AMC recently with our Wall Street bets. So if the price goes up, you're margin called, and then you lose your coins that you've posted as collateral. So going short is a really risky proposition because if the price keeps going up, you could get short squeezed. However, there is a method to go short without getting short squeezed. It's called buying a put. So when you buy a put, you pay someone the privilege of selling Bitcoin to them at a certain strike price at a certain date. So what I do is I say there's an expiry. So the date is December 2021. And I will I want the optionality of selling you the Bitcoin that I have at $40,000 a Bitcoin, no matter how low it goes. And so what you do is you pay the counterparty a premium for that privilege. If Bitcoin is above $40,000 at the end of the expiration, your option expires worthless and you pay that premium for nothing. But you now have protected yourself against that downside risk. Now, the problem is puts are expensive, especially with Bitcoin's volatility. The counterparty who sold you the put goes, well, I don't think, you know, like if Bitcoin goes down a lot, man, I don't want to like, you know, that's a lot of money. I'm going to have to fork over to like buy that Bitcoin from you at $40,000. I mean, Bitcoin could go to zero and they still have to buy Bitcoin from you at $40,000. So the premium on there is based on it. There's a lot of different factors. They're called the Greeks. Ultimately, the premium is largely a function of delta and of the implied volatility. So TLDR, you can a put would be the best way to do it. If you felt very convicted that the market's going to drop, a put's a good way to do it. Ledger X is a US CFTC regulated exchange. They're not super liquid, but you can get, if you're a retail trader, you can get size there, a size that should be adequate enough. I think that's really cool as a way to minimize your downside exposure. Again, you've paid the premium, which means that if it does not go below that strike price, your premium, your option expires worthless and you've paid that for nothing. Mm-hmm. But that is a good way not to get short squeezed. I would not like to short any crypto asset. They're all very volatile and a lot of them have, you know, really tremendous jolts upward that mm-hmm. can be unpredictable. And so, yeah, buying a put would be the safest way to do that.
Mm-hmm. Can you share anything about, your leading growth at Kraken? Can you share some stats at all and like what type of growth you guys are experiencing? Let's say, has it sped up in recent months? What percent are you growing per year in terms of just new users? Just curious, whatever stats you could share, I think that would be actually pretty cool.
Yeah, so I can't share too much, but I did get approval from, and I gotta actually open this up. I'm sorry I didn't memorize this before.
No, go for it. Yeah, yeah.
This is where we gotta fit. You know, there's some pretty cool stats I wanted to share.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's see. I want to make sure I get this right too. All right, let me pull it up. It's been pretty insane. Let's put it this way. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you noticed, but if you do a Google search, Kraken ranks number one for the term buy Dogecoin. Hmm. That's under the growth team SEO function. We are, you know, that was a lot of traffic. I can't mention how much it was, but you could imagine, given that Elon's tweeting about it, it's an unfathomable amount of traffic. So that was pretty cool. And let's see. Yeah, so I wanted to make sure I had this right because I thought I had this right, but I just want to double check. In January, our volumes were larger than the entire year of 2019. Wow. So January 2021, our volumes were larger than the entire year of 2019.
Volumes in terms of transactions users are doing?
Trading volume.
Okay.
Yeah. So pure aggregate trading volume. And we, in the last month, our signups have increased 1,000%.
Wait, 1,000% year over year or month over month?
Month over month.
Wait a minute.
I had to double check, and this is from my comms team.
Are you serious?
Wow. 1,000% increase in signups this past month.
Wow.
So I got this from the comms team. They approved me to say it. I wanted to double check because it was so crazy. I mean, let's put it this way. Like, most of us haven't had a lot of sleep over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And it's been a wild time. I mean, both Coinbase and Kraken, you know, we're trying our best to keep everything up and running, and we're just, yeah, it's all hands on deck. Wow.
That is insane. That's 10x. Wow. I mean,
Facebook didn't. Facebook and Uber didn't 10x in 1 month. I mean, seriously, especially at our scale.
Yeah. I mean, I hope you and the growth team there get some bonuses or something, you know, like this is ridiculous.
Maybe we can replay this video for Jesse when I go.
Yeah. Actually, I just saw his, an interview by him, today, and, definitely introduce him to this video. You guys deserve definitely, a shout out. So in the US, what percent does, of let's say the crypto kind of exchanges out there, what percent does Kraken hold versus Coinbase versus some other players?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we think about that from like different currency pairs. So you could look at total aggregate volume. You could look at volume sliced by pairs. I think volume sliced by pairs is a great way to look at it. Like, BTC USD or BTC Euro or ETH Euro, ETH USD. We have a larger percentage of our market share in Europe. So in Europe, we are the predominant source of liquidity for both ETH and Bitcoin Euro pairs. So that is our strongest market in terms of market share. In the US, we're one of the strong contenders, but of course, Coinbase is the largest player in the US. So for us, you know, it's us and Bitstamp that own a pretty sizable chunk of the US market. But, you know, of course, again, Coinbase comes in to take a large chunk of that.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Dan, this has been fascinating to chat about this stuff. I mean, I do so actually out of great respect for Bitcoin and the goals and the future of Bitcoin. I'm curious, where are you coming from? Are you on the West Coast right now?
Yeah, I'm on the West Coast. My ring light got a little shiny as the sun went down.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, on the West Coast, I'm in San Francisco. Cool. I've been out here for 8 years. I was part of the, yeah, I mean, back in 2013, there was Brian and Fred from Coinbase and Jed Michaela from Stellar and about six other of us, Charlie Lee and a cooler of PBRs at a place called 20 Mission. And that was where Bitcoin's like physical like meetup happened in San Francisco, January 2013. That wild to see how far it's come from that tiny little group. I'm nearly non-billionaire in the group. And just to see how far it's come is pretty wild. I mean, both in same with Jesse used to go to those meetups too. Jesse Powell, CEO of Kraken. So just crazy to see how far we've come. Yeah, Bay Area was a really unique time back in 13 just to see this emerge. So yeah it's crazy.
Awesome. Dan, what? How can people find you on YouTube and Twitter or elsewhere?
Yeah, so on Twitter, I'm most active. It's at Dan Held. Beware of imposter accounts. There's a lot of them. This is a systemic problem on Twitter. And then if you like my thinking around Bitcoin, if you want to get a little bit more in depth other than my more, you know, kind of pumpy tweets, I like to put out Twitter content that gets the people going. If you want something more in depth, if you want to hear my thoughts on like the rise of mega corporations or how states might attack Bitcoin, which is a previous topic that I wrote about, I write about these in my newsletter called the Dan Held Report. You can also just Google Dan Held Substack. And so on there, for my free subscribers, it comes out once a month. For my paid, it comes out once a week. So that's where you're going to get my kind of raw thoughts of how I'm thinking through different topics.
Awesome. I'm going to go ahead and add some links in the video description. And just wanted any last kind of thoughts or things you want to say to the audience?
No, I hope everyone enjoyed. You know, you're definitely getting a perspective of someone who's really into Bitcoin. I think there's been a lot of other great people that you've had on that talk about different other topics. I'd encourage everyone to explore. Mm-hmm. Go listen to this, go listen to other ones, go listen to more Bitcoin things. But, you know, at the fundamental core, try to get a good grasp of what Bitcoin is before you jump to everything else, because that's the starting point. Mm-hmm. Once you understand that and really dig into that, then go explore these other things. But again, you've got a lot of great content. I'd recommend that everyone go check out these other videos that you've done with other crypto folks.
Awesome. All right, Dan, thanks for the time. I appreciate it. And yeah, it's great to meet you and chat with you.